Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. In this edition of Radio Curious, we're going to talk about Bonk, subtitled The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex. Some people may find the explicit and frank discussions contained in this program offensive. If you do, or think you may, change your station or turn your radio off now. Bonk is written by Mary Roach, a science journalist based in Oakland, California, and reports the studies of volunteers who became comfortable with all manners of implements, machines, pokings, and proddings as they, quote, assist in the march of scientific progress. The promotions for her book say, forget the flowers, candies, ballads, and valentines. This is the real deal. What happens, why, and how to make it better. Mary Roach has always gravitated towards the peculiar, covering things like Eskimo food, flatulence, vaginal weightlifting, carrot addiction, and amputee bowling leagues. Some of the areas of Bonk that we'll leave to the reader of the book, penises and clitorises aren't the only organs with erectile tissue. The reason your nose gets congested during a cold is that the nasal erectile tissue expands. Nasal congestion is an erection in your nose. Women, like men, get nocturnal erections, but not the nasal variety. Autopsy data on fatal heart attacks during sex suggests that they are rare. It may or may not comfort you to know that in most cases, sudden death occurred during the sexual act with a prostitute. When I visited with Mary Roach by phone on April 14, 2008, we began our conversation when I asked her to define what an orgasm is. So again, if you believe that you may be offended by the content of this program, this is your last chance to change the station or turn your radio off. Mary Roach, welcome to Radio Curious.
Thank you.
In your book, Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex, you have some discussion of orgasms. Why don't we begin with a description of what an orgasm is?
An orgasm, as it's been defined to me, is a reflex of the autonomic nervous system. And it's a reflex, it's an interesting one because it can be triggered by stimulus from ranging from the more obvious genital stimulation to completely mind-based stimulation, sometimes spontaneously triggered. People who have spinal cord injury develop much more sensitive areas above the level of the injury. In other words, they may be able to achieve orgasm by applying a vibrator to their chest or their back at a certain point. So it's a fascinating reflex, and I had not actually ever before thought of it as a reflex, but that's apparently what it is.
Well, what occurs physiologically?
What occurs physiologically? That's an interesting question because it's very, very hard to find a defining physiological hallmark of orgasm. There are, in women, there are these contractions that happen that Masters and Johnson claimed were defining elements of orgasm, vaginal and uterine contractions, although some people have found women who will say they've had an orgasm, yet there were no contractions. And when researchers study orgasm, the one thing that is most reliably evident is a sharp drop-off in pulse rate and respiration rate after it happens. So in essence, the aftermath of the orgasm is the most reliable indicator, physiological indicator. It's a kind of an elusive entity.
Well, in a less clinical description, how would a person know if they're having one?
Well, sometimes people don't. There are particularly women. I've known women who weren't sure, because there's orgasms range from 1 to 10 on a scale, and you can have a fairly subtle one and not really know whether you've had one at all because you have nothing to compare it to if it's your first one. So I think that sometimes people actually don't know for sure.
How long do they typically last?
They typically last 26 seconds. One study showed that people reliably underestimate how long they lasted. They're an average of 12 seconds longer than the person remembers them to be.
Well, when you say people underestimate them, how was the survey taken to be able to determine these estimates?
They had women come into a lab, and they measured, they had them indicate when the orgasm was beginning and ending, and then afterwards they said, and how long would you say that orgasm lasted? And they would then look at what they'd said versus how long it really was.
In relationship to a stopwatch, yes, running outside of their view.
Yes.
Well, you're talking about female orgasms. What's the difference between a male orgasm and a female orgasm in terms of the physiological responses that you're mentioning?
You know, that's something that, again, because nobody has been both a man and a woman, it's difficult to say. They've had men and women take a survey in which they circled words that apply to their own orgasms, and they've compared men and women's responses, and there's not a significant difference in the in the words that people use.
What are some of those words?
Oh, they range from, you know, prickly, tingling, euphoria. I mean, it's a broad range of words. One interesting thing was that someone actually looked at vaginal versus clitoral orgasms to see if there was a difference in the qualitative state of them. And again, there wasn't a significant difference across the whole study population in the way that they were described. Although most women I know will say that they're like different types of wine. There are subtle differences.
Were you able to discern the variable or what causes the subtle difference, or is that more of an emotional and environmental circumstance?
No, nobody was able to pinpoint any physiological difference in male or female orgasm in terms of, I mean, other than the obvious fact that men ejaculate and that there's that whole process that is happening. So that's a question that, you know, I often said, well, if it's muscle contractions, then why doesn't it feel orgasmic to contract your muscles on your own? Why is it only if it's a passive, autonomic response? Why can't it, you know, why can't you flex those muscles and have it feel good? And nobody, of course, has an answer to that.
You mean as you can flex your arm muscles?
Exactly. Because if it's the contractions that are associated with orgasm, you'd think that then you would be able to feel something pleasurable when you flex them yourself, but that's not the case.
As opposed to flexing them with a vibrator or some other external stimulus.
The contractions that happen involuntarily when you have an orgasm. In other words, if there's, you know, these vaginal contractions that are going on in the muscles, the pelvic floor muscles and the vaginal walls, you know, if you were to, you know, why doesn't it feel good for you to flex them using your own willpower? You know, do you know what I mean?
And being a man, I'm not quite sure what you do mean. Tell me.
See, this is the problem. Well, there's also, well, it's the same with men. There's there are a couple of muscles that spasm when you have an orgasm. So it's, and that has been referred to as, you know, that some of the pleasure is derived from the involuntary flexing of those muscles. But if that were the case, you'd think just squeezing those muscles would also feel good.
There's some comments, although I'm not sure I identified them in your book, Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex. In terms of male orgasms, ejaculation without an orgasm and an orgasm without ejaculation.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any investigation into that area?
That is something that was a surprise to me as a woman. I guess I hadn't given it that much thought, but the fact that they're all independent events, I hadn't realized that, because this came up. I was watching a surgeon who was installing some implants into the erectile chambers of a patient, someone who has had erectile dysfunction, a fairly severe and something that didn't respond to Viagra. So anyway, they're putting these implants into the erectile chambers, and I said, God, that's I guess you can't take them back out and go back to the way you used to be. You're basically reaming out the erectile tissue. And he said, no, you can't. And I said, well, then, since the erectile tissue has been destroyed, does that mean the man can't have an orgasm or ejaculate? And he said, no, they're all independent, that you don't have to have an erection to have an orgasm or ejaculate, which was news to me.
Did he explain how that can occur? And I presume that would be an issue for men who have had prostate surgery.
Yes, that's right. No, he didn't explain. They're separate events, and that they're not dependent on one another.
What I'm inquiring is, was there an explanation for how to stimulate a non-erect penis to orgasm?
The same way you would stimulate, a vibrator. People with spinal cord injury, often men with spinal cord injuries frequently can't get an erection, but can actually have orgasm. And if you use a strong enough vibrator, there's actually a specific kind of vibrator called the FertiCare. It's used to help men who want to collect their own semen to have children. They use this it's a higher amplitude, it's a greater stimulation than the average vibrator, and so that's one way it's done.
And how about female ejaculation? Have you had any investigation into that area?
Yeah, there's a number of people have done studies on trying to determine what the nature of the material is, and there are some who say, oh, it's just urine, and there are others who are very vehemently say, no, it is not. And there have been studies. There was someone who did a study, a very simple study, where the subject drank a blue dye, which would then have colored her urine, so that and then she then made the point that the residue on the bed was not dyed blue. There are people who have tasted it and said it doesn't taste or smell like urine. Of course, that presumes that they know what urine tastes like. There are still those who say that it's mostly urine, and there are those who say it's not. So it's an argument that continues to go on.
Well, in anatomical studies, dissecting cadavers, for example, there is no gland in the female pelvic area that would produce a fluid, is there?
There's a vestigial prostate gland. There are, if you look in there, there are little sort of pieces of where the male prostate is. There are actually sort of vestigial elements of a prostate in the female.
But then wouldn't there need to be tubes or viaducts to get it into the vaginal vault, as you describe?
One would think so.
Is there an anatomical difference in women who ejaculate versus women who don't?
That would be something you could only determine, I guess, with a post-mortem. One would think that would be a logical explanation, that say perhaps these women have more of this vestigial prostate gland, or that perhaps there's something else going on with them that sets them apart. You'd have to have a population of women that you've identified who have this ability, and then you'd have to look at them in a post-mortem, I guess, to really prove it.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Mary Roach, the author of Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex. If you just tuned in, you may find this program to reach into topics that you might prefer not to hear. If that's the case, listen to some other program. But now you're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Mary Roach, there appears, from my perspective as a man, that there's a difference in the number of times that men think about sex versus the number of times that women think about sex in any given time period. Have you found that?
Yes, I think that is related to testosterone being the main driver of libido, and men have more testosterone than women. Also, you'll see a difference in women across their menstrual cycles in the number of times they report thinking about sex or masturbating or initiating sex, and that peaks right around the time that they're fertile, and that is when their higher testosterone rates. I mean, the balance of estrogen and testosterone is all complicated and tied in with one another, but there is definitely a time of the month when libido is highest. Women report having more sexual thoughts and essentially being a little bit more like men.
That libido is affected by birth control pills.
Yes.
And it levels it out throughout the menstrual cycle.
Yes, that's correct. It does. It provides enough estrogen so that the body shuts down its own factories, as it were, but it doesn't match the peaks in hormone levels that you would see around the time of ovulation. So you're losing those peak days. You just have a sort of flattened out, averaged libido.
Have you found any sociological implications of the effect of birth control pills on a woman's libido?
I actually asked my own gynecologist about that, and she said only about a third of women notice or complain about it. And she said that what you're also dealing with here is that once a woman is on the pill, she's having more sex, not less, because she's less concerned about getting pregnant. She's, you know, freed up. She's not worried and anxious about whether or not she's going to get pregnant, and therefore she's more relaxed and able to enjoy sex more. So the sex is possibly better. She may not be as compelled to initiate sex as she was before, but she's having more sex and possibly enjoying it more. Not that many women complain about it. The end result of being on the pill is a positive thing for her rather than a negative in a lot of cases, even though there is a slightly lower libido level around than she would have had with her own hormones.
Homo sapiens are about the only mammal that cares if they're seen having sex.
Correct. Yeah. Isn't that strange?
Where does that come from?
I guess, well, we're also the only mammal that covers our genitals and wears clothing and has manners. And, you know, it's culture. We've got this tremendous, you know, centuries of culture that's built up and has shaped us in ways that we don't even think about day to day.
Yet, if we look at some of the South Seas, the South Pacific cultures, particularly where before Christianity was imposed, women would walk around with their breasts exposed.
Mm-hmm.
So a new culture was brought.
Yes. Western culture, I guess you would say, specifically. And I don't know, you know, it would be interesting to look at cultures where there is essentially nudity or mostly nudity and whether people in those cultures have sex within the visual range of other people. I don't know.
Mary Roach, author of Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex, what did you find as the differences between men and women with regard to images and specifically pornography, or what is called pornography?
There was one thing I learned. There was an interesting body of work by a researcher named Meredith Chivers, and that what she found is kind of runs contrary to stereotype. She found that men have very specific tastes when it comes to pornography, or that is their physiology, their physiological responses are very specific. They respond to images that correspond to their own sexual orientation. If you show them heterosexual sex, they will have a reaction to it, a sexual reaction. And if you show them two men having sex, they won't have that reaction, you know, or two apes having sex, whatever. They specifically respond to images that reflect their sexual orientation. Women, on the other hand, will respond to any sexual imagery. And when I say respond, this is using a device that measures genital blood flow. So it's not that you asked them a question. You didn't say, hey, do you find this sexy? Does this turn you on? It was, is there a statistically significant increase in genital blood flow? And with women, there is that increase across the board. If you show them two women, a man and a woman, two men, they will respond physically, sexually. Dr. Chivers even showed footage of bonobo apes mating and got a response. That's not to say if you asked the women afterwards, would they say, oh, yeah, I found that very sexy. I was very turned on. They might not even notice it but it is taking place.
So what you're saying, there's a physiological response when female Homo sapiens see images of copulation where there is a more defined as to who the actors are if men view it.
Yes, with men, it's got to correspond to what they like, or what they themselves are attracted to.
So, to their sexual, yes, personal sexual,
yes,
preference.
Right. The one exception to that is that if you show men lesbian sex because they're seeing two naked women, they will have a reaction, partly because of that. So it isn't. That's the exception to the rule, the general rule.
And how about the brain as the largest sex organ?
I think that's a very valid point to be made. I think that just on a neurological level, there are brain triggered orgasms. If you put an electrode in a certain part of the brain, you can, although it's not easy to do and it hasn't happened very often, you can trigger an orgasm simply through stimulating a certain part of the brain. There are women who can use imagery to achieve orgasm, and I think anybody you ask would certainly say that your own state of mind plays a huge part in how good the sex is or how intense the orgasm is.
You have an interesting section on what's called premature ejaculation. Can you tell us about that?
The interesting thing about premature ejaculation is that from the standpoint of evolutionary biology, it's actually a useful thing. In other words, if you're a primate, say, and you're very speedy in your copulation, you are likely to have fewer aggressive encounters. You're going to be in and done and gone before most of the other apes or whoever it is see what you're doing and come over and try to establish dominance and beat you up. So it was a useful trait. And so much so that there have been papers written saying, why do we call premature ejaculation a dysfunction, when in fact it serves a useful purpose in terms of our own evolutionary history. There was the one paper I saw, the guy said, as long as you aren't ejaculating before you're inside the woman, then it shouldn't be really called a dysfunction. But of course, a lot of women would disagree with that. But anyway, it's interesting to think about. It's curious that, in fact, the Homo sapiens typically takes a lot longer than most of the ape species. The chimpanzees, like 7 seconds is like the duration of intercourse.
For chimpanzees?
Chimpanzees, yeah. They're very, they're in and out, very quick. They're very aggressive, and the males, the younger, less dominant males are very likely to get thrashed if the dominant male sees them mating with a female that they want to mate with. So it's very useful for them to be very quick.
It was curious to me, although not unanticipated, that in the world of gay and lesbian couples, you write that they seem more comfortable in the world of sex, and you describe it as gender empathy. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. This was based on a study that Masters and Johnson did in the 1970s, where they brought in straight couples, gay couples, and also long-term versus people they'd matched up. And while everybody in that study was pretty efficient at having sex and reaching orgasm, the best sex seems to be the couples that were long-term gay couples. And one of the things that Masters and Johnson pointed out was this notion of gender empathy, and that is to say, if you're a gay couple, it's pretty fair to say, if it feels good to me, it's going to feel good to him or her. So you know intuitively what feels good, what kind of pressure, how hard, how long, where, etc. You don't really have to ask or fumble around and figure it out because, you're a woman or a man, and so is your partner. So they benefit from that. The gay couples were less goal-directed. In other words, they were they really lost themselves in sex and then their own partner's responses and, liked to tease and draw things out, and it was the very marked contrast from the straight couples who were kind of trying, they were trying to sort of do the right thing, push the right buttons for the right amount of time, but it was very goal-directed, and they seemed to want to just hurry up and get the woman to orgasm and be done with it.
That was the goal?
That seemed to be, yeah, that the, you know, orgasm was the end point, and they were sort of, you know, doing what they could to get there rather than luxuriating in all of the foreplay and the buildup of tension and everything like that.
Which you described as suspense at a high level of sexual excitation.
That's actually Masters and Johnson's wording, yes. Yes, that's right.
So, Mary Roach, what excited you to write this book?
I came across an article in Film Quarterly, of all places. I came across this mention of the films that Masters and Johnson had made using a penis camera, basically. It was a see-through phallus with a small camera and a light source, which enabled them to film a woman's sexual responses during sex, specifically sex with this phallus, because it was attached to a motor. It was actually an artificial sex machine. An artificial coition machine is what they called it. And I read that and I thought, all right, sex research, that's got to be the next book, just because it was such a, it's such a bizarre juxtaposition of something that is so intimate and personal and yet belongs in the realm of physiology and biology and deserves to be studied.
And something that everybody thinks about and few people discuss.
Yes. True.
Mary Roach, thanks for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Oh, sure. I read this book called The Atlas of Human Sex Anatomy. It's an extraordinary book, and you can find it on Amazon. And it's by this gynecologist who is alive in the 1890s and doing this extraordinary work. He's the one who got Kinsey interested in sex. He was doing this stuff before Kinsey ever did, and he's an extraordinary man, and he's an artist, so it's got all these amazing illustrations, and it's an unbelievable book. And it used to be under lock and key, sadly, in libraries because of the explicitness of it, but it was really the first time anyone ever produced an informative, honest, anatomically explicit book about human sexual physiology.
Well, Mary Roach, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thanks very much, Barry.
Mary Roach is the author of Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex. The book that she recommends is The Atlas of Human Sex Anatomy. This program was recorded in the studios of Radio Curious on April 14, 2008. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. And the phone is 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.